Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Slowly the bets got larger, and the dealer, keeping up a constant patter about how easy it was, see how often these guys win, began to chide the tourist for his misses. See how this guy, pointed to me, does it? Finally, after the tourist had missed on a $60 bet, the dealer asked me to point out the 10, and without turning it over, to just look under a corner to see if I was right. I said I was, and he said, "Show this guy. Put down $60, turn over the card again, and you can win." I refused. "That wouldn't be fair to you," I said. So he had Black Beret do it and win $60. They all made fun of me, and some others now gathering around did too. I felt my heart going, pulsing in my head as the game continued, and then the same sequence developed again. A miss by red tie, constant patter, invitation to look, right again. Then insistence by all, I turn up the card again and take the sure winner. I thought of the ticket I'd bought for Death of a Salesman, four times what I'd ever paid for a play before, and I thought about other plays I wanted to see. I took out my wallet, counted, looked down to count, $149 for all the rest of the trip, and watched myself put out the $60 and turn over the card. Three of diamonds. I was dazed. The game went on without a hitch, mostly wins by Black Beret and stretch pants, losses by red tie. But the pace accelerated and the crowd was growing and talking, some commiserating with me. I tried to pull away. The patter motored on and I knew the panic of loss, of betrayal, of desire. I wanted everything to stop. I wanted bitterly not to have lost, to be back at Burger King before all this, to have watched the cards more carefully. But I could still see, as a great calm in the frenzy of talk and shuffling, the cards, and how right I was each time. The patter focused more on me. "Turn it over, see? You're right. Put your money on it. I owe you one. I'll make it up to you. This time, three for one." Black Beret was helpful, like a kind uncle. "Do it," he whispered. "He wants you to win it back. It'll get the crowd with him." The dealer's eyes were enlarged, protruding, the mouth constant. I looked into my wallet and, with a lurch, put $60 down and turned the card over. Six of hearts. "No, look, it's this one," said Black Beret sympathetically, turning over the tin. The crowd jammed in and swelled its noise. "That isn't fair. You promised him." "Mind your business," in a snarl from the dealer. Then a quick glance toward Fifth Avenue. "Uh-oh, cops coming." And the crowd left, and dealer, Black Beret, stretch pants, and red tie walked quickly together toward Broadway, leaving me frozen, spent, swirling in a tempest, damned, gaping, clear only about one thing. I was the mark, the only mark. As I stood there and then walked east, I was absolutely serene and absolutely violated. Calm, unsurprised to see no police descending on the illegal game, intensely aware of people, food carts, lights, dimming sky, but cordoned off, invisible. I walked down Fifth Avenue to the library and then up to the reading room and got out my paper for the Shakespeare meetings to go over until Greg came, but I could not see the words. I watched a lady across the table in a print dress, an imitation fur-colored coat, fur-collared coat, which she kept partly buttoned. She had notebooks and folders full of bills and receipts and lists and slips that she kept shuffling and restacking and poring over and making new lists from. First, I thought she was balancing her checkbook, but she kept going over the same things, shifting in her chair, restacking the lists, sighing, copying new figures, pursing her lips, returning to the notebooks and then the slips of paper, erasing, writing, always intent. I couldn't tell what it was. I had to stop watching. Greg and I walked back along 42nd, past Burger King, to Broadway, where we went underground and caught the B train local up to 79th. Greg could see something was wrong, but didn't pry, just stopped suddenly, twice, to look at me as we talked, and once put his hand on my shoulder. We got off and walked back to 76th, where he had booked tickets for Sam Shepard's A Lie of the Mind at the Promenade. But that was 1986, wasn't it? "Let me send you a check. I'm a little short on cash," I asked. And he said, "Sure," and didn't object when I suggested that. Instead of going to dinner before the play, we walk down to Lincoln Center and see the Chagall windows in Avery Fisher Hall and grab a soft pretzel with mustard on the way. "My favorite tourist indulgence," I said, with just the right touch of self-mockery. My mind had come unfrozen enough to begin to calculate how I could make it home on my remaining $29 without getting any more money or admitting my plight, and in a way that would make me suffer. That seemed very important. $1 for the subway, one for the pretzel, another dollar fare to Greg's apartment in Brooklyn after the play. But what about getting to the airport? As we walked, Greg filled me in on his job with a new TV production company, but he could tell I was preoccupied. "How can I get to LaGuardia from your place by 7:30 in the morning?" I suddenly asked. This must have been 1984. He stopped and looked at me, but then went on. Well, you can sleep in, have one of my great breakfasts, and take a taxi right up there, maybe 20 minutes, he said. Or you can get up at 5, leave me asleep, grab a piece of toast, and take the subway back in here and then out to the airport. Give yourself 2 hours. After a moment, seeing I was serious, he added, the taxi is $20. The subway plus the bus from the nearest stop is 2. When we came back to the theater and got our programs, Greg told me we were in the old Manhattan Ward meeting house. He pointed to the unusual arched doorways and alcoves and blocked-in windows as we went through the foyer and up the stairs into the main theater. When my eyes adjusted, I could see the huge encompassing arches on 4 sides that had framed the original chapel and supported the dome above. The space was now filled on 3 sides with banks of seats, with a wide stage on the 4th and a catwalk above. In the program I read, quote, first constructed in 1928 as a Mormon church. The building was refurbished and officially opened as the Promenade Theater in 1969, New York's only off-Broadway theater on Broadway. Shepherd's play, one of his earliest, is a preparation for the more well-known Fool for Love. Both plays chart the agony of Western misfits, grotesque and universal in their irrational revenges and bizarre, literally or spiritually incestuous loves. Greg doesn't like Shepherd's work, had gotten the tickets after my phone call only out of kindness, but I find Shepherd the most attractive as well as troubling new American dramatist. He is willing to use the bleak lives and dry landscapes and tacky motels and vicious words that are one part of a section of America usually neglected in drama, the 20th century West I grew up in. And he does not merely imitate those lives, but invests them believably with the great human themes of love and death and with passages of poetry and even occasional, quite unrealistic, but believable epiphanies. For instance, at the end of this play, Jake, who has nearly killed and then deserted his wife in one of his recurrent fits of jealousy, returns to tell her that her reality, the truth of her generous, ingenuous being that has so infuriated him, is also what makes all other ideas and presences unreal, merely a lie of his mind. In an act of amazing mercy, which her unique reality has taught him, and finally made possible for him to do, he gives his life to preserve her, and in doing so, finally changes himself. It hurts very much to think of you. How could you suffer not only our pains, but our sicknesses and infirmities? Did you actually become sick and infirm, or merely feel, with your greater imagination, something like what we feel when we are sick and infirm? How could you actually know according to the flesh, as you say, if you didn't literally experience fully with your body? And if you did literally experience our infirmities, did you know our greatest one, sin? Everyone says you didn't sin, that you were always perfect. But how then could you learn how to help us? And yet if you did sin, if you actually became sick and infirm and unwilling for a moment to do what you knew was right, how does that help us? I don't want you to hurt like this, like I do now, to be ashamed, to hate the detailed, quotidian past. Yet I want you to know the worst of me possible, and still love me, still accept me, like a lovely, terrible drill, tearing me all the way down inside the root until all the decay and then all the pulp and nerve and all the pain is gone. Can't you tell us directly, without all the mystery and contradiction, if what I feel is right? Could it be that your very willingness to know the actual pain and confusion and despair of sin, to join with us fully, is what saves us? It's true. I feel your condescension in that. I feel you coming down from your formidable separate height as my judge and conscience. I feel you next to me as my friend. Did it happen in Gethsemane when you turned away from your father and your mission for just a moment? I think so. So how can I refuse to accept myself, refuse to be whole again, if you, though my judge whom I hide from, know exactly what I feel and still accept me? Yet it hurts so much to hear you tell of your pain to Joseph Smith when you remember that moment in the garden. You say, which suffering caused myself, even God, the greatest of all, to tremble because of pain and to bleed at every pore and to suffer both body and spirit, and would that I might not drink the bitter cup and shrink. Nevertheless, glory be to the Father, and I partook and finished my preparations unto the children of men. Was that preparation so painful, even when you recalled it as the resurrected Lord, and so many hundred years later, that you still shrank and could not complete your sentence? Is that pause between shrink and nevertheless the actual moment of the atonement? And why did you also tell Joseph that you will be red in your apparel when you come, in garments like one that treadeth in the wine vat? Why will you have to say then, I have trodden the winepress alone, and have brought judgment upon all people, and none were with me? Who is it can withstand your love? In the mid-70s, I sometimes went fishing at North Eden. That tiny delta and valley opening into the east side of Bear Lake in northern Utah was homesteaded along with a similar, smaller valley, South Eden, late in the 19th century. Two small reservoirs were built in North Eden to hold water through the summer for irrigating hay fields and perhaps a few gardens. Someone planted the reservoirs with rainbow and brook trout, and together with the native cutthroat, they grew into huge fish in those isolated, food-rich lakes. The cutthroats lean, fierce fighters, the rainbows and brookies jeweled and heavy-sided. One of my father's complicated business transactions had left him with a partial interest in the one remaining ranch and a key to the gate at the valley's west end that kept most people away from the reservoirs. On a mid-August morning before sunup, one of Dad's clients, who insisted on taking his Jeep Wagoneer, drove us east from Salt Lake City to Evanston and then north along the Utah-Wyoming border through Woodruff and Randolph and down the long incline to Lake Town on the south shore of Bear Lake, then up the east side. I was alone in the back seat, only half listening to my father's usual cheery commentary and storytelling. My own thoughts were dull, almost despondent. I had been released from St. Olaf College the year before in what looked to me and some colleagues like a decision to remove my influence on students, one of whom had joined the Mormon Church. Then I had been turned down for a position at BYU, apparently because of concern about what parents might think about the influence of a person of my unorthodox views and background would have on students. But I was also turned down at the University of Utah because, as one of my former teachers there confided with regret, this department simply won't hire an active, believing Mormon. Which was I, too devoted a Mormon or not devoted enough? Where was my home, my vocation, in Zion or in exile? We had moved to Utah and were subsisting on part-time institute teaching for the church in Ogden and Salt Lake and a writing fellowship in Leonard Arrington's church history division and a huge garden at our home in Kaysville. And I had begun to lose confidence. Perhaps I didn't have a job simply because I wasn't good enough, didn't have enough good publications and teaching evaluations to overcome those other qualms administrators were having. After all, I hadn't been accepted at the other places I had applied either. I had felt the mantle leave me when I was released as branch president in Minnesota, and no spiritual security had replaced it. I found it hard to pray, to remember what it felt like to bless my branch members and family with complete assurance, and to know with certainty the Spirit's response. I wondered constantly, in blank repetition through broken sleep as we drove, if I had lost my way, if the Lord knew any more there was such a person as me for him. I wondered where the deepest part of me had gone. We had our boat in the higher lake by 7 and headed for the upper end, where the fishing just out from the stream mouth had been best in late summer. I sat in the prow facing the early sun and the sharp canyon wind, smelling the water and watching the long scar the mule-pulled Fresno scrapers had made long ago, bringing down fill for the dam. Suddenly I saw to my right a V in the water, much like our boat's wake, but very small, moving rapidly across to the shore on our left. I silently pointed, and Dad slowed so that we intercepted the double riffle just behind a 4-foot rattlesnake, moving with the same motion it makes on open sand, its yellow on black diamonds and beige rattles and thick body clearly visible under our prow. None of us said anything. Using wet flies cast with a bubble, we each took our limit of 3 trout over 5 pounds, and by mutual agreement of those fishing on this private lake, put the many others we caught back. 2 that my father caught using his own self-designed version of a double woolly worm that ended in a red tuft must have weighed over 8 pounds. We tried some dry fly casting in the early afternoon, and I watched a huge brookie rise to take my dragonfly, and then, coming in, suddenly turn uncontrollably under the anchor rope and snap the delicate leader close enough I could see the rich scattering of blue and red-gold aureoles down its side. I felt it go with no regret. By 4, the wind up the canyon off Bear Lake was too strong for good fishing, and we left. Dad and I both offered to drive, but the client, who had taken a nap, insisted he wasn't tired, and for variety headed around the lake to Garden City and down Logan Canyon, with me asleep lying across the back seat and Dad dozing in the front. When I came up out of unconsciousness, I had my hands on my father's head and could feel his hair and blood. I couldn't hear the words I was saying, but I felt it from the blessing part of me, the deepest part, before consciousness. Dad was more conscious than I was, but more hurt. I gradually began to see the ground, the fir trees, then the cars just down from us. There was a blue Austin impaled at a slight angle into the front of the Jeep. All of the Jeep's doors were sprung open, and the freezer of huge fish was splashed across the highway. I kept my hands on Dad's head and began to hear his moaning, then felt pain emerging in my own chest and began to struggle to breathe. Police came soon and told me our driver had fallen asleep and run head-on into the Austin, which was driven by a German tourist whose legs had been broken. Ambulances were on the way. Each new face asked me where we caught the fish. Our driver, who wasn't hurt at all, kept apologizing frantically. He knew my father was dying. When the ambulances came, they put Dad on the first one and tried to get me to lie down by him, but that made it even harder for me to breathe. At the Logan Hospital, they made me lie down for x-rays of my broken ribs, and I nearly fainted. But then the technician told me they had seen what looked like a bruise on the upper aorta in my father's x-rays and were going to rush him to Salt Lake because it could burst at any moment. I asked the technician if he would help me give my father a blessing, and he nodded and went for some consecrated oil. We found Dad on a gurney in the next room, barely conscious, the whole left side of his face, where he had struck the dashboard, going purple. I blessed him with life, specifically with the 5 years he had told me that spring he needed in order to complete the arrangements to consolidate our family investments and transfer them into the church's missionary funds. The words were given to my tongue, beyond my mind. I called Charlotte and Mom and told them we'd had a slight accident, to call Dad's friend, the heart surgeon Russell Nelson, and to meet us at the LDS hospital. But all confidence left me on that 90-minute, sirens-blaring ambulance ride to Salt Lake. I sat in the front seat, Dad and a doctor and nurse just behind me through a curtain. As the driver radioed ahead, asking Dr. Nelson to be ready and describing the emergency, I was constantly sure someone would soon push through the curtain to tell me the aorta had burst and my father was dead. When we arrived, they rushed Dad into surgery, and Charlotte stayed with me while I got us checked in and walked to my own room. Then I couldn't breathe again. Charlotte got them to look at my x-rays, which I was carrying. They decided that my collapsed lung needed immediate attention and sent Charlotte out, while an intern gave me a local, made an incision, and pushed a hollow needle between my ribs and began to evacuate the chest cavity so my lung could reinflate. Charlotte came back to tell me my father was fine, except for some missing teeth and a broken jaw. The new x-rays they took for Dr. Nelson showed no bruise on the aorta. I thought of the fish, the brookie, and the part of me that moved to heal my father before I knew anything. We were all alive. I made it back to Manhattan, another $7, leaving me $11, in time to meet Greg for the matinee of Hamlet at the Joseph Papp Shakespeare Festival Theater near Astor Place. "Put both these tickets on the tab for that check I'm sending you," I said when he came up. "I owe you for the toast." I was anxious to see what Liviu Seuli, the great Hungarian director who is now in charge of the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, would do with this difficult and, in my opinion, usually butchered play, and to see the popular movie actor Kevin Kline do the lead. This was certainly 1986. I was disappointed in both of them. More of the same traditional misreading of the play is simply a struggle by a romantic intellectual to get enough courage to take bloody revenge on the uncle who killed his father. Soleil's best direction was to let the costuming and instincts of the actors follow Shakespeare's words and show Hamlet becoming more and more like his monstrous uncle as he succumbs to the revenge spirit. By the play's end, the poison that symbolizes that spirit, initially dropped by the uncle into Hamlet's father's ear, is now like the words of revenge that were as a result dropped into Hamlet's ear by the father's ghost, and then as a further result into Laertes' ear by Claudius, spreading to corrupt and finally kill them all. Soule also allowed Harriet Harris to play Ophelia in a way that let the words speak true, even against the rest of his direction. She was able to show a woman and her innocent love being ground to pieces between the sinful male honor of Hamlet and the sinful male protection of her father. After the play, we walked up past Christopher Park and found at the corner of West 4th Street a quartet of young men, two on violin, one viola, and one cello, just beginning Haydn's Sunrise Sonata. They were about the same age as Stretch Pants and the trumpet player in Montreal, that's from a section I skipped, but dressed in Levi's and T-shirts, like the dealer. They were excellent musicians, and most of the rowdy crowd stood quietly or passed by carefully. Nearly everyone put a quarter or two into the open case, but I waited, thought, felt within me the war of blame for the con game and guilt and racism against all my opposing beliefs, and furtively put in $5. As we caught a bus up 7th Avenue, I told Greg I thought I'd get some rest before Easter, left him at his station on 42nd, and transferred across and up Madison to the empty apartment on 63rd that Dave and Karen Davidson had lent me for the weekend. I bought bread at the corner deli and explored the refrigerator, but still felt I shouldn't eat and slept uneasily. This is my report. I have been assigned to George England, one of my descendants, for 30 years now. He carries my own name but does not use George often, though that is his first name. I have protected him well, but I do not understand him. I think I should remain on this assignment for at least one more 10-year term. The main problem is that George understands what is right to do but does not do it. He knows more about the atonement than I did when I was branch president in Lyme Regis, or even when I became a patriarch in Plain City after the crossing to Utah. He writes constantly about it, even when he is writing for the Gentiles about literature. And many people praise him for what he says. They write letters to him how he helped them live the gospel better and helped them understand repentance. But he still does terrible things. It is still hard for him to be honest. He covers over his mistakes with lies. He pretends he knows things or remembers people or has read books when he has not. I think he loves to do right, but he has a hard time being honest or kind when the chance to do so is sudden or embarrassing or when he is painful or lonely. If he has time to think, he is very often good, but not when he is surprised. When I helped him marry Charlotte Ann, you know how much better he was for a while. He began to learn from her to be generous before he thought about it. He even began to be honest like she is without toting up the cost. But after all that self-pity when he lost his job at St. Olaf 10 years ago, he began to be a hustler, to cut corners, to take advantage. I was able to use that car accident to help him know he was good. And when you arranged for him to be a bishop, that was fine for a while. But he seems to have lost contact with Charlotte Ann. He isn't listening to her very well, and he isn't telling her what he really feels. I think she is getting tired. Perhaps he is writing too much. I'm certain he is not praying enough. He is worried, though, and wondering, sometimes frantically, I think, why there is not someone to help him the way he has helped some who have needed him. He does not seem to be able to ask for help. Perhaps something will happen that we can use. I hope so. My heart aches and reaches out to complete the circle. I think some good chances will come now that he is in a bishopric again and working with the primary and the Cub Scouts, and also when he becomes a grandfather in 2 years. I'm sorry about the language of this report. I know you want me to learn from him, but it is hard when he talks so very little. You must excuse all mistakes. I couldn't sleep and then overslept, so I had to run all the way up through the Easter-dressed people on 5th Avenue to make it to the Metropolitan Museum of Art on 81st by 10:30 opening. I paid $1 of the $4 suggested contribution, leaving me one last bus fare plus just enough to get to the airport next morning. I went right to the Rembrandts and Vermeers, but even there I found I could only focus for long on two paintings, Rembrandt's gentle Christ with a pilgrim staff and Vermeer's quiet, consuming woman with a blue pitcher, the young housewife working calmly in that corner of a room that Vermeer painted again and again, as if to understand the whole world through one place seen completely. Then I hurried down the long hall past the antique pianofortes to the south wing, Manet's white apparition, woman with a bonnet, framed in the doorway as a beacon visible all the way. But I turned quickly to find my favorite Manet at the far right, the dead Christ with angels. Critics of the 19th century French Academy did not like the extreme realism, the precisely bird-like blue wings on the two angels and the heavy, black-shadowed cadaver. But I find the moment captured by Manet extremely moving. It is not the traditional moment of shining glory after life returns. It is the dark time of struggle as Christ's divine spirit is still creating the resurrection from within his still dead mortal body, with the angels still sorrowing, holding him up, urging life to return. I agree with Émile Zola, the French novelist who wrote of Manet's obstinate eye and audacious hand, his ability to imagine and realize such angels, those children with great blue wings who are so strangely elegant and gentle. These are the angels Mary Magdalene saw later when she found the tomb empty, the two still sitting, the one at the head, the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. At the front of the painting is a snake, the one from Eden, its head about to be crushed according to the promise. I took a bus across Central Park to the chapel on the second floor of the church-owned office building on 65th and Broadway so I could make sacrament meeting at 12. After the sacrament service, there was a short Easter musical program before the regular testimony meeting. But if this was 1986, then it was the last Sunday of March, rather than the first Sunday when Mormons normally fast for 24 hours and bear testimony. And the printed program, I say, proves that it was indeed Easter. At any rate, after the choir's Easter hymn and a woman's quartet singing the Lord's Prayer, the choir leader, Andrea Thornock, I see from the program, sang, "He was despised," from the Messiah. She had dark hair and wore a long, surplice-like overdress. It was made of what looked like velvet and was dyed a striking grape red. Her somber alto voice reminded us of the costs of salvation. "He was despised, rejected, a man of sorrows." Her voice pronounced exactly the grief in that three-note dying fall on sorrow that must have told Handel's own pain. She looked straight into our eyes, slowly turning her head across the congregation. "He did not hide his face from shame and spitting." Then Liz Hodgen, in a lovely floral print and pink hat, sang the soprano solo that has been called by Kenneth Clark and others the greatest piece of human music, "I Know That My Redeemer Liveth." But it is greatest, I believe, when it is sung by someone like Liz, who believes, who sings her own testimony as well as Handel's. And our hearts were lifted from the depths Andrea had properly taken us down to. I blessed Andrea for planning such a program and for being part of it, for remembering, though we Mormons don't often notice Good Friday, what that somber day is meant to recall, that Christ was suffering servant as well as glorious victor, that like all of us sinners, he had to die before he could be resurrected. The bishop bore his testimony not about the resurrection, but about the power of repentance which he had experienced personally. A brilliantly dressed businessman picked up the theme by confessing in a careful, broken voice how Christ had changed him 20 years before, suddenly, completely. A short man with a beer belly, thinning long black hair, and a black leather jacket, almost a caricature of the aged hippie, spoke softly of his long, slow, still backsliding conversion. And a young Puerto Rican on the bench in front of me, who had been visibly struggling for courage to get up, spoke last. He told how a few weeks back he had made a Saturday trip to see this strange part of New York, had wandered into the LDS Visitor Center on the main floor just below us, and had met some missionaries and joined the church. He tried to describe his former sins and how he had changed. "I'm sorry in all the world," he kept saying. "I'm sorry in all the world."
Gene is too modest to tell you that his essay has won the Lowell Binion Award for a dialogues contest, essay contest. I woke up this morning with a cold directly, so I've asked my good friend Don Luther to read two essays from my book. I have put this book together as sort of an autobiography, a collection of essays about my life that most of them have been published in Exponent, Dialogue, and other places first. But I picked one from Exponent, a short one called Diet Dialogue, Going from the Sublime to the Ridiculous, and a longer one, a new one about my father called Gentle Dad. Oh, maybe you know Dawn Lou. She gave a wonderful paper. Was it today or yesterday? She's in Provo, a writer and editor, and a very fine writer, a very fine editor.
Diet Dialogue. Now that summer is here, it is time for a diet dialogue between myself and myself. Self. Why is it that even though I have placed a picture of a Vogue dress on the refrigerator door. I have just opened that same door and wolfed down a generous pot of potato salad. Sylph. Because you put the picture on the door. It called attention to the door. You long ago learned to resist the motivation of Vogue. But I want a new dress for summer. Isn't that motivation enough? No. In your heart of hearts and underneath those layers of fat, you think that somewhere there is a dress that will make you as glamorous as if you were thin. But I really am trying. I heard that most fatties eat too fast. So by setting the stopwatch and chewing every mouthful 23 times, I managed to slow down to 10 minutes. How can I reach the 45 minutes that diet doctors suggest? By eating more food. Thanks a lot. You're a big help. Helpful, yes. Big, no. Come out of there, I say. Not until you stop stuffing and start stiffening. I want to know why I can't be satisfied with one treat at a time. Why can't I stop at one M&M? Because sugar breeds a desire for sugar. But I do it with bread and yogurt and everything else. You are not feeding the hunger of the body, but the hunger of the soul. Don't get pious with me, Sylph. What I mean is, you eat to keep from doing something important with your talents. I have noticed that when I am scared about something I have to do, like introducing a bill on the floor of the Senate or opening on Broadway, I can't eat. Most people function best when just a little hungry. Not dying of malnutrition, you understand, just a little hungry. The question then becomes, how can I stay scared? By looking in the mirror all of the time. You don't have to insult me. I also find that when I try to concentrate, I want to eat. Your body tries to sabotage your mind. Try the smell of rotten apples in your desk. Rotten apples? What worked for Schiller might work for you. Was he thin? No, but he was a great German poet. Maybe you could be one too. Sylph, you mock me. No, I am a mock-up of you, a thin version of you, and I can't come out until you stop clogging my doorway with food. I have founded my own little diet of the month club. Every month a new diet. Why won't a diet do it? Your problem is not finding the right diet. It's not wanting to diet. I do want to diet. Why do you think I'm so miserable? Of course I want to diet. No, you want to lose weight, but you don't want to diet. You are a spoiled, self-indulgent. Stop! I am trying to be healthy. Why, I've been buying my snacks at the health food store instead of a pastry shop. Why can't I lose on pumpkin seeds? Because you eat 5,000 of them. I have heard people say that those who don't like to eat don't like to do anything else either. They aren't even sexy. Wouldn't I rather be sexy? Is fat sexy? Why isn't it possible that I like to eat just because food is good? Must I be suffering from suppressed hatred of my mother or fear of the world or something awful like that? No, but isn't it possible to enjoy it half as much? Do you have to gobble up everything on the plate and then chew on the porcelain? Stop. You're right. It's a question of will. When will you begin? Why not declare a fast day? Not just once a month, but once a week. On fast day, I eat the same as I do on every other day, except I eat it faster. You're impossible. Okay. I want to be thin, but not badly enough. What should I do? I don't know. But if I don't get out of here soon, you'll forget all about me. Remember how you cried when the scales hit 115? Remember how you felt when you were 4 months pregnant, weighing in at 129? Now think how happy you were last year when you got back down to 140. You may just escalate me right into the grave, if you pardon the mixed metaphor. Okay, I promise you this, Sylph. I will let you out very soon. Right after Christmas. these names from the cherry orchard. Should I just guess?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Gentle Dad. The ground must be cleared. You must tear down all the old outbuildings, for instance, which are worthless, and cut down the old cherry orchard. Lopakhin in Chirikov's cherry orchard. The phone rang at midnight. I groped it sleepily to my ear. It was my father's high priest group leader calling from Utah. "We are here in ward council meeting," he said. "We've just arranged to have your father's orchard bulldozed." I sat up, wide awake now. "The whole orchard? Isn't that a bit severe?" He agreed that it probably was, but my dad had given them orders to take the whole thing. The ward leaders had declared a Leo Lithgow day and were hiring equipment to help clear the orchard and the garden in a general cleanup. It had suddenly occurred to them that Marion Dennis might not like it. I told them that I would prefer to save the live trees and that I would talk to Dennis in Boston and to Tom and Gay in Salt Lake. Then I stood up and started pacing. Vivid pictures flooded my mind. Me as a child in the cherry trees, me picking pears and apples from the lower branches while Dad picked from the higher ones, warm and juicy apricots and plums, and alfalfa feathering my legs as I ran through the fields and up to the irrigation ditch to dip my feet in the water and smell the fresh mint. I cried. I even went to the bookshelf and took down Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard. Lamenting the loss of the family orchard, one of the characters says, "Oh, my childhood, my innocence. I used to sleep in this nursery. I looked out into the orchard. Happiness awoke with me each morning." Gaev says, "Yes, and the orchard will be sold for our debts." And Lyubov Andreyevna adds, "Look, our dead mother walks in the orchard in a white dress." The play, a distant sound that seems to come from the sky, the sound of a snapped string mournfully dying away, a stillness falls, and nothing is heard but the thud of the axe on a tree far away in the orchard. At daylight, I called Tom in Salt Lake City. I told him that when Dad's bishop had offered to help clear the orchard of dead trees, limbs, and weeds, Dad had said, "You may as well take all the trees." "Trees keep the air fresh," I said, "and they keep the land from turning to dust and blowing away. Dennis and I would hate to come to Utah and find that our family homestead had become the little house on the prairie." Tom promised to save the trees. Dad had planted the trees nearly 55 years ago after moving into the house he had built for his bride, my mother. He had worked hard to keep the trees producing, and he had taught his children to pick. The cherries had to keep their stems as they dropped into the bucket. The pears had to be yellow, but not too soft. The apples burnished with gold or red, depending on their family name. Astrakhan, Jonathan, delicious. How the names make my mouth water. In summer and early fall, we used to help sell the fruit, lining it up in bushel baskets in front of the house. As soon as prospective buyers pulled up, I would call for Mother to make the transactions. I was not good at making change. In an oral history interview, Dad recorded that in good years, our acre yielded more than 250 bushels of fruit. We also sold Mother's private crop, raspberries. Every July, Mother would suit up for the assault on the tender berry among the thorns. Long stockings, hat, sunglasses, even stockings on the arms. Occasionally, she would draft me as helper. If keeping stems on the cherries was a trick, gently detaching the ripe raspberry from its convex holder required a dexterity it would take me years to develop. Of course, if the berry wasn't ripe enough, it wouldn't come. If we should be clumsy enough to disturb it before its time, it could be lost. Mother had just the right light touch, as she did at almost everything she put her hand to. Dad, however, did not have the light touch when it came to the pruning of trees. One year he lopped off one half of the perfect V from one of two paradise trees in our front yard, leaving a gnarled wound where a backrest had been. After he chopped down the cherry trees, I asked him whether he had discovered buried treasure. "What treasure?" he asked. "Ruth and I buried a tin can with some letters in it that we weren't supposed to dig up until the trees were cut down or until we married, whichever came first." Ruth was my mother's youngest sister, only 4 years older than I. No, he hadn't found our treasure. What did the letters say? They were prophecies. Mine said Ruth would marry Tom Chalice, and Ruth said that I would marry Kenneth Huffman. I was proved right, Ruth wrong. I asked Dad why the trees couldn't have remained standing as a kind of monument to my childhood. My favorite Bing cherry tree had a strong limb for chinning and a perfect seat for me to hide in with my books. It was my fantasy tree. I was Tarzana of the Apes, Wonder Woman, and Anne of Green Gables. My tastes were nothing if not eclectic. After all, I told Dad, the trees weren't in anyone's way. In fact, they stood as a protective fence between us and the world to the north. Dad replied that dead trees were a menace and an eyesore. He also had a penchant for spraying the trees with arsenic. Mother finally went out on that, though, and he stopped. From then on, the fruit was small, but juicy and plentiful. It always seemed to me that his practical attitude toward trees didn't mesh with his soft heart. We could always tell where he was sitting in church because he would loudly clear his throat when he was trying to control his tears. Any scripture, testimony, or musical solo could bring them on. If one of us should be on the program, we could count on his sniffling throughout. Dad could usually discipline us without such props, but he reminded us that Mother was the one who was stuck with raising us during the years when he worked two jobs. He must have spent quality time with us because I vividly recall his stories, his night nursing during flu season, and an ear to our complaints. He had an imaginative way of calling us out of nightmares. Sitting on the edge of my bed, he fed me segments of oranges until my blood sugar reached a high enough level to chase goblins away. Why then was he so hard on the trees? That question puzzled me so much when I was young that I penned a poem called Dad So Gentle. Dad sang in the morning as he called us from sleep, but he sometimes wore overalls white with the spray of death. Dad, in his reading voice, hesitated over our stories at night, and by day his shears crippled the paradise trees. I never showed this poem to him, and I forgot about it until the time came for clearing the orchard. Tom reported that Dad had watched the path of the bulldozer with sadness and some agitation. He seemed glad to have the work done, but sorry too. When I visited him a few months later, I walked around what was left of the orchard and the garden. The logs from the trees were piled behind the garage, and the raspberries were gone. Recent rains had turned the ground to mud. A stand each of apple and pear trees guarded the house on either side. I paced around the remains of the barn, remembering Buttercup and Daisy, our two milk cows. Dad had tried to teach me to milk with indifferent success. I loved to watch him milk, though, pulling from his three-legged stool as foam gathered on the rim of the bucket. He would carry the milk to the kitchen where he would strain it through cheesecloth. In winter, Mother would set the milk in pans on the front porch. After the cream rose to the top, often with a thin coating of ice, Mother churned butter and created one of my favorite elixirs, fresh buttermilk. She would then store the buttermilk and the cream in the old ice box on the back porch. In his oral history, Dad says that during his first 10 years on the railroad, the two cows gave enough milk for him to sell 20 pints a day to his fellow workers and several quarts to the neighbors. Of course, the cows had to be fed, so in summer Dad rented a team of horses and a hay rack so my brothers and I could stomp the hay down after Dad forked it up to us. Sinking into the prickly cloud, we rode it home where we stomped it again while he arranged it in a stack near the barn. So many memories of the orchard and the barn. My childhood, beginning in the Depression, spanned a transition period called by some writers the Great Leap. I remember when we changed from coal to gas, when the cook stove in the kitchen and the heating stove in the living room were torn out to make way for the electric stove, the refrigerator, and the furnace. I remember when the county sewer finally snaked its way through our neighborhood, replacing the cesspool. After I'd finished my weepy walk through the mud and weeds of the denuded orchard, I had time to notice how very tired Dad seemed. He kept sighing. It's a heck of a note, getting old. I reasoned that he probably hadn't eaten lately. I knew he'd given up fixing food for himself except for an occasional can of soup or a frozen chicken pie. Tom and Gay often brought food, and we had convinced the ward food brigade that instead of casseroles, a plate of food from their own dinners would be best. Dad didn't seem to know what to do with leftovers except feed them to the chickens. Before Mother's death, he looked so tired that we almost believed Mother when she said, "Dad and I are going to die together." But after his long service as Mother's nurse ended, restful nights and outdoor chores seemed to strengthen him for a while. But now he seemed distant and distracted. He reported hearing Mother's voice calling in the night and the ringing of early morning doorbells. On my visits, I noticed that during the first few hours he appeared pessimistic and sad, but after a few days his spirits would rise. He and I would watch television together and his sense of humor would improve noticeably. I thought I knew what he needed, company. Sitting alone most of every day was giving him too much time to brood. "Dad, why don't you come and visit me in Washington? We could have someone watch this house. I have a nice room on the ground floor with a television and everything you need." He refused, as I knew he would, but I continued to hope that one day he would visit me, and then if all went well, he might want to move in. Meanwhile, I urged him to talk about his early years in Cowley, Wyoming, that small town that was part of what church historians call the last colony. My grandfather, Thomas Lithgow, was one of the first pioneers to build a house in that barren frontier, a log cabin as rustic as any in the Old West. A picture of it with my dad's family in front had appeared in the Improvement Era many years ago. When Mormons talk about their four-generation pioneer heritage, I can say, I don't have to go back any further than my grandfather. Having already settled on a fertile farm, dairy farm in Granger, Utah, grandfather uprooted his family. Dad, the eldest, was 4 years old. This was in 1900, when the Brigham Young style of settling impossible areas was supposedly over. Cowley historian Mark Partridge claims that many converts arriving in Utah from foreign lands forced the church to look for a suitable arable land in neighboring states. I am puzzled at this explanation. Surely Utah's population was still sparse enough in 1900 for people like my grandfather to stay put. The method they used to locate land puzzles me even more. In the dead of winter, a party of 13 men was dispatched to Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. With Apostle Abraham O. Woodruff at the head, they arrived at Eagle's Nest, Wyoming, where they met with William Cody, Buffalo Bill. He hinted that the Mormons could share his permit to construct an irrigation system through a large part of the Stinking Water area, or the Shoshone River Valley, near a small branch of the church in Burlington. With that, the party returned to Utah and recommended that President Lorenzo Snow call a few hundred families to the Bighorn. My grandmother's brother, George Harston, was in the first company of covered wagons. He pitched a tent on the Salt Sage Flats near the river and sent for his wife and family, his brother, Will Harston, his sister, Mary Harston Lithgow, and their families. They left fertile dairy farms in East Mill Creek and Granger for a land that would be without water until a canal more than 30 miles long could be constructed. Partridge reports that there is no evidence that any samples of the soil were taken before the pioneers were called. He admits that since the exploring party spent only 2 days on the proposed project, the investigation could not have been very thorough. "Why do you think they went?" I asked Dad. "I don't know. It sure was a mistake." I was taken aback by that answer. Having listened to Dad's colorful stories about the characters in his hometown, I had always believed that Dad was cherishing a rosy picture of life in the ranch lands not far from the beautiful Bighorn Mountains. When I was 16, Dad had taken Tom and me to Wyoming on the train. It was a grand adventure for me, my first trip out of Utah. We stayed with Uncle Will, where I promptly fell in love with his 20-year-old son, my cousin Garner. I tried to drive a tractor, tried to ride a horse, watched the irrigation process over a vast terrain, watched the dry lake where couples like to spoon, and took a trip to Montana to check fences on another Harson ranch. I formed a lasting attachment to the scenery. My diary records that in Cowley I felt free. In Salt Lake there are too many houses, trees, and mountains hemming me in. Since none of our relatives approved of my cousin love, I vowed to remain single until such time as I could find another dark-haired, green-eyed, open-hearted young man like Garner. I mourned the end of my visit to Cowley. That happy week is gone, gone, gone. What will I do? Garner is my standard for a husband. If I can't have him, I want someone with those same wonderful qualities. Not surprisingly, my choice of husband 10 years later turned out to be a young man very much like my cousin. Anyway, it came as a shock to discover that although Dad could discourse lovingly on life in Cowley, he was more romantic about it than he was about dead trees. My father blamed Uncle George for the trek to Cowley. He was a pioneer. He drove a team from here clear out there, swimming across rivers and everything else. According to Dad, the pioneer spirit meant that Uncle George always had to be going somewhere. He couldn't stay in one place. I remembered Uncle George as an old man with white hair and pink skin who used to stay with us in the summers. He had a cleanliness fetish and could be heard washing his already transparent skin over and over in the night like Lady Macbeth. One summer, the pit underneath the black lawn had to be dug all over again. Though no one blamed Uncle George aloud, it was understood that he was the one who finally flooded the cesspool. We were fond of Uncle George, though, partly because of Dad's adventure on the ice. One night when the motherless boy, my father, was out hunting Paw, he found him with Uncle George sawing ice on the Sage Creek Reservoir. When Dad started across and fell in, Uncle George pulled him out by the shirt collar. Pa wrapped me in a blanket and we got on Old Pint and away we went home. Uncle George was always kidding me about trying to walk on the water. It was sad that this hardy pioneer spent his last years wandering up and down the West Coast and the Inner Mountain West, finally dying alone in a motel. He left Cali for another farming adventure in Idaho where his wife died and left him alone. He started wandering, finally taking a job in California. We were given to understand that his last visit to Cali had brought on a depression that never left him. It seems that everything had changed direction. His former house was on the wrong side of the street. The town he had helped build from scratch was no longer home to him. The sun rose in the west and settled in the east. As a basically directionless person myself, I think I understood Uncle George's despair. As I questioned Dad further, I realized that neither he nor I knew much about my namesake, my grandmother. She had died in childbirth, leaving my grandfather with 5 children, 2 sons and 3 daughters, Dad being the eldest. The brief entry in Partridge's account describes her as a woman whose house and children were always neat and clean. Other family members have declared that she possessed a beautiful singing voice. At her death, her other children went to live with Uncle George's family, leaving Dad alone with his father. Using an injured foot as an excuse, Dad dropped out of school. His father said, "If you're not going to go to school, you're going to work." As co-owner of Collie's first threshing machine, he put Dad to work cutting bands on the thresher from early morning until late at night. I pictured the 13-year-old going home alone to the little log house. Land, it was darker than a stack of black cats in that town. There were no lights, you know. Pa wasn't home, and I'd go climb into bed scared to death. Sometimes I'd get a horse and go hunting Pa all over town. So while alone with his son, Grandpa decided to give him the gift of work. Whatever job I could do, I worked hard at, and I gave all the money I earned to Pa. I tried to remember what Grandpa Lithgow was like. Uncle Billy, Dad's half-brother, describes him as a real cowboy. At the age of 86, he could leap on a horse bareback and rein in a herd of runaway cattle. Lean, wiry, tough, he was also a deeply caring person. Uncle Billy told this experience. "I was 15 and worried about the big questions of life and death. I finally screwed up my courage. I asked Pa what he thought death was. He didn't hesitate. He said, 'Death is the greatest adventure in life.' When he came to his last illness, he called me in and told me that he didn't want to be given drugs that would knock him out. I want to be there when I die." When Dad was 20 years old, his father married Rosetta King Black, Cully's first school teacher and a widow with 6 children to add to Tom Lithgow's 5. Shortly after the Lithgow family moved to the Black Farm, Dad tried to enlist in the Navy. He was rejected because of flat feet. Then, in one of the many ironies of his life, he was accepted into the Army Infantry, where he walked on his flat feet through training periods in Utah, New Mexico, and New Jersey, then to the front lines in France, arriving a few days after the armistice. He survived the flu epidemic of 1918, during which his fellow soldiers dropped like flies around him. At 26, he was asked to serve a mission for the church. "Did you want to go?" Dennis asked him. "Land, no. I didn't know why the heck they wanted to send me. They just kept after me until they talked me into it. I said I would go as long as they wouldn't make me talk at the farewell." He was called to the California Mission, where he spent most of his time in Nevada, Elko, Reno, Susanville, Tonopah. He claimed he was not a good missionary. "I was no preacher." When he was released, Dad did not return to Cali, but to Salt Lake City, where he had inherited some land from his mother. In fact, the trip Tom and I took with him was his first trip back since his mission almost 22 years before. And he worried all the way there about the possibility of being asked to deliver a missionary homecoming speech. In Salt Lake City, he found a job as a blacksmith helper on the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad and married another California missionary, Agnes Anderson from Ephraim, Utah, who died 10 months later in childbirth. It was 1930, and 4 years later when he married my mother, Lavinia Mitchell, and settled on his land in a new frame house. We were sitting out there almost all alone. One of his sisters lived next door, and there was one other house farther down 20th East. We could see through the poplar trees across the street, almost down to Highland Drive, 2 miles away. Listening to Dad and rereading his oral history interview, I realized that his buoyant spirit and sense of humor had kept me from noticing the hardships of his life. Unemployed for 2 years during the Great Depression, he had almost lost the house. After that, he worked 2 shifts a day at the railroad. To the question, "Did you have to work that hard?" he answered, "I thought I did." When diesel engines replaced his labor, he went to work for a neighbor who had constructed new houses on the east bench of the Wasatch Mountains near East Mill Creek. His job was to superintend the private water system that serviced the homes. Beginning with 2 pumps, the system expanded as more houses were built. He had to hook them up to the meters, fix any leaks, keep the pressure up in a system of pumps and boosters that, after his retirement, was sold to the city. He liked the work. It kept me interested. I liked it a lot better than the railroad, and I made more money. It kept me thinking. At night, I had to regulate it so that in the morning, I'd have all the tanks full. If I didn't have the tanks full in the morning, they'd be out of water before night. His duties, keeping the tanks full in the morning so they wouldn't go dry at night, became a symbol for me. In the mornings, he came in and closed my bedroom window singing, "Oh, it's great to get up in the morning in the good old summertime." Though I tend to be a night person, I formed a desire to be like him, to welcome each day and to put in a full day's work on whatever I chose to do. As his 90th birthday approached, we children decided to celebrate. Dennis, whose youngest son had never met his grandfather, decided to take his whole family out to Salt Lake from Boston for the occasion. When Dennis called to tell him, Dad said, "I may not be here." Dennis laughed and assured Dad that we would all be there. I arrived a week early and stayed with Dad. Dennis, his wife Marty, and their children were with her parents a few blocks away. Tom and Gay were busy planning the party that we had decided to keep secret from Dad until the last minute. A similar plan for our parents' 50th wedding anniversary had worked out beautifully. Dad had been sharing his dreams with me, dreams in which he heard Mother calling to him. And when he gets out of bed to go to her, he meets only the lonely silence. He admitted that he had fallen in his bedroom a few times. I began to feel uneasy about plans for the party. Suppose he's not up to it. A few nights later, I took my laundry to the washing machine in the basement before leaving for a meeting. Since I knew Dad had stopped going down the basement stairs, I instructed him not to worry about my laundry. I would soon be back. An hour later, I was called to the phone. "Your father is in the hospital." Dennis had found him unconscious on the floor in the basement next to my laundry. His head had dented the water heater and bled on the cement floor. By the time I arrived, Tom, Dennis, and the bishop had administered to him, and the attending physician at the emergency room had decided that the blow on the head had resulted from a heart attack and not the other way around. Attempts to revive him failed. We stood around his body as it lay covered with a sheet on the table. Al Johnson, Gay's husband, said a prayer. Instead of a birthday party, we planned a funeral. A few days later, as I looked out the kitchen windows at the pear and apple trees on the south side of the orchard, I was happy that they were still standing, still changing color. On the morning of the funeral, I looked out just in time to see a rainbow-striped hot air balloon as it floated past the trees and disappeared somewhere in the direction of the lake. I took that as a sign that Dad's buoyancy was still a force in the universe. Rex Curtis, our cousin and one of Mother's funeral speakers, told us that he believed the spirits of the dead hover over us until after the burial. That was a comfort, but it did not keep me from waking in the night and worrying about my part in his death. He should have died quietly in his sleep when we were still here to keep him company, or he should have died while telling one of his college stories. Instead, he died trying to serve me, so like him, when I should have been serving him. Finally, one morning I awoke with the awareness of a particularly vivid dream. In the dream, Dad is living in my home in Virginia. He approaches me as I prepare to serve breakfast, puts his arms around me, and whispers, "Mary, I love you." Then he sits down at the table and quietly dies. Obviously, the dream had restaged his death according to my needs. I could see that the dream was also telling me that I was making progress in my mourning labor, that I was learning to forgive myself. I already knew that Dad had forgiven me. Now my regrets center around wasted time. Why hadn't I spent more time documenting his life? Dad was such a good storyteller. Why hadn't I been less selfish, more attuned to his needs, to the rhythm of his life? I wish I had asked the same questions Uncle Billy had asked his father. How did Dad feel about death? Was he getting ready for it? And would he welcome a chance to talk about it? At least I think I now understand his attitude about the trees that were no longer producing enough to pay for the space they occupied. He believed in giving a full day's work in return for his own space. No longer able to care for the aging orchard, he no longer wished to look at the neglected trees, nor to sit alone in his life.
This story takes about 24 minutes, and it's one of a number of stories I've been working on too slowly and too long. I think it's nearly finished now. It's called Her Father's House. Dalton took some of her sick days, turned things at the store over to her assistant, flew in from the coast, and rode a limo 40 miles to her birthplace. She spent a week, and adrenaline kept her going like a whirlwind. Her father was 81 now, and always somewhat of a pack rat, not the hermit who never throws a newspaper or can away, but not far from it. She had to fight her way into the attic and basement, filling leaf bag after leaf bag full of junk mail, old pay envelopes from 15 and 20 years of gas card receipts, empty boxes, used book mailers, church bulletins, 19 bags in all. "Daddy, how could you let stuff pile up like this?" she said, starting into the attic the first day. "It isn't sanitary. It's a fire hazard." "Oh, honey," he said, "you know." He licked his chapped lower lip, waved his right hand out and downward in dismissal. "Well, it can't go on forever." She felt herself looming over him and took a step back. "You can't leave such a mess. Mother could never have tolerated this." Aline was a tidy woman. "You depended on her too much. You're like a little boy who won't clean his room." He set his head back and frowned, wearing his khaki work pants and shirt button to the top, silver and turquoise buckle and matching bolo tie. She wiped her palms on her jeans, turned and went on rummaging in the mess, then called back to him. "Do you have some garbage bags, big plastic bags, any kind? Bring some up." When he did, she'd already started to raise a dust that was making her sniffle, tightening her throat. "I'm going to need a mask," she told him. "Can you bring me a big hanky, something?" He left again and brought her back a big blue bandana she tied across her face. "This is incredible," she said. "We're going to need a planner. I'll never finish by Saturday night." He was backing down the stairs. "Hey, hold up," she said. "What's that?" "You helping is part of the plan. At least carry down the bags I fill." "Okay, Frito Bandito." He raised his hands. She grinned at that, aimed a finger gun at him, almost giggled as when he'd clowned in her childhood. But when she watched him carry the first bag down, setting both feet on every step, she knew the arthritis in his hip was too bad for this, and his grip on the bag's neck looked desperate. His fingers had been slow twisting the tie. She let him go, but when he came back, she told him she couldn't have him do that. "It's going to be too hard," she said. "I won't be coddled," he said, "nor managed, Madam Sportswear. I'll use you some other way." It wasn't long before she started finding things he didn't want to throw away, like a smashed-in carton of Louis. "Why not give these away? You may never read them." "I might," he said. She tried to stare him down on that one, but he just carried the carton downstairs. That night she saw it beside his bed and considered sneaking it into a bag. She also started finding things he never should have lost, like several uncashed checks and shoeboxes of old receipts and invoices. She took those right down to the kitchen where he was making tomato and cheese sandwiches and waved them under his nose. "Daddy, there's $130 here, yours. It would have been good for something. I can't believe you lost stuff like this." He slid the checks from between her thumb and forefinger and held them in the better light from the window. He'd almost never turned lights on in the day. "Too old to cash now. This one, refund from Spiegel's for return merchandise. They sent another one when it hadn't gone through. And who are you anyway telling me what to do with what's mine? Road agent?" She pulled down her bandana, dabbed and rubbed it around her throat. Her sweat stung. "Have it your way," she said. She'd meant not to let him get to her. "Me and Rosie Greer," he said. It took her a minute to remember the commercial, too late to laugh. She started making enough such finds that she thought it the better part of wisdom to hoard them up for mealtimes or breaks. At lunch, when she'd finished her sandwich first and wiped the juice off her fingers, she pulled a stack of important family papers and photographs from under her chair and laid them on the table between him and her. "Good thing you found these," he said. He riffled one-handed through the pile, holding his sandwich up like a poker hand. "Here's you, FFA sweetheart. You wouldn't come see me crowned. That hurt a long time. You knew why. I wasn't supposed to be proud just because a bunch of shit-kickers thought I was pretty, or just the least horsey girl running. Wasn't supposed to even wonder whether I was or not. Doesn't seem to have hurt. You still are. She plowed her chair back across the linoleum and stomped back up the stairs, stung by more than sweat. She'd stopped using language like that in college, and here she was throwing a tantrum. By Monday afternoon, she knew her hunch had been right. A yard sale would be part of the plan. There was going to be tons of stuff no one in the family would take, but kids coming back to school, young couples furnishing apartments, ought to go for. "Hold a what?" he said. "You know a yard sale," she said. "You must have seen people having them around town. Signs up, furniture all over the lawn, clothes hanging from trees." He handed her a glass of lemonade she knew would be too sour. "Yards of peace goods, I believe in. Front yards, if people keep them neat. The lumber yard believed in that 40 years. He stiffened his back. "Yard sale?" "You're clowning," she said, and sipped and managed a grin around the taste at the back of her mouth. "Me?" he said. "Mean every word, gospel truth. Anyway, what's the matter? You and your sisters won't have this stuff." "We don't need it, just like you don't." "Call Goodwill, then. Call the Salvation Army. I'll do just that for everything you don't sell." "Me sell? Honey, I put in my time." "Uh-uh. If I stand out there making change and haggling prices, I'll never get through the house by the end of the week. I'll set you up, cash box, change, but you're going to do it. I'd just as soon let people steal it." "You ought to get some good out of it." "I did." "Just do it, Daddy." He looked like he wouldn't, but she went ahead, phoned in the ad, which wouldn't appear till Wednesday, though she planned to start putting stuff out Tuesday, then spent the last hours of Monday afternoon buying a cash box, blank stickers, and big felt-tip markers at Kmart, cashing three traveler's checks for $60 change, stopping at the lumber yard for dust masks, which they gave her free for her father's sake. Tuesday morning, when she put one on, he intoned through cupped hands, "Calling Dr. Welby, Dr. Welby in ER. Scalpel. Easy on the gas. You'll put him all the way out." "You're not exactly funny," she said. "You neither," he said. Monday night, looking into closets and drawers and bedrooms, she added another element to the plan. Sorting time. They'd spend an hour or so starting now. He'd sit on the bed. She'd pull out articles one at a time. He'd say yes or no. If yes, she'd hang it back up or fold it back into an empty drawer. If no, she'd drop it into a big carton to be laid on a table or hung on a line for the sale, for Goodwill if it didn't sell. She held this to an hour the first night, needing time to write signs on the sides of big cartons to set at each end of the block. Done with that, jet lag compounded by exhaustion, supposing her father long since asleep, she called her husband. "I don't know if I can do this, Evan. You should see the piles of stuff. I'm thinking of quitting. How's he going to take it?" "I wonder if I can." "You can. So how's he?" "Tough as an old cedar post, but he can't really help. His arthritis. Only he's going to drag his feet, too. It's like I have to haul him around as well as the junk." Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Well, more like grumble, grumble. After the call, she lay in her own old bed, feeling tritely alien, a stranger in this stranger's room, where a mother and father had taken turns leading a child through her prayers, then left her to her privacy at age 10. She hadn't lost the habit till somewhere in the succession of other rooms in college, where she believed she'd found reasons. He'd lost the habit, too, while she was in school, but had started going to church again during her mother's last illness. She lay wondering what her father was feeling two doors down, whether he prayed now. Before she blankly slept, she heard a cough and the sound of him turning in bed. They got into a sort of routine, putting out sales stuff, then he to watch the cash box and she to go on cleaning, coming out to the front lawn for breaks, joining him in the kitchen for meals, then taking him to one room or another for sorting before bed, then calling Evan. Tuesday morning, there was a little confrontation. He'd risen earliest, and she didn't like his way with eggs, though she wouldn't say so for the world, so she wanted to fix breakfast, but he was set in his way, so he wanted to. Finally, he proposed a truce. "Let's us each fix our own." All right, if he'd let her fix his on Sunday. All right, if she'd go to church with him. She couldn't. Her flight. Still going pagan, was she? The friendly skies. He'd gotten more religious, apparently. He said grace at supper, only that meal, but every time. "Our Father, accept our thanks for this food, for Jesus' sake, amen." Asking nothing, repeating it as if by rote, not inviting her to do it. She got him set up. He'd bought out a stack of three Louis L'Amours, and he made no bones about leaning halfway back in the chair with the footrest up and opening one in front of his face before she went back in and up to the attic. From up there, looking out the small window now and then, she hardly saw him move. Few people came that day, but she was sure more would tomorrow. They'd arranged the pieces of furniture as if in rooms, and the scene from above seemed a curious everting of his privacy, in which he reclined as if stunned by the bomb that had knocked the walls flat. Mid-afternoon, in a drawer of an old dresser filled with worn underwear and old nylons, stuffing for pillows, she found a small pair of gold-rimmed spectacles. She held them in her hand, looking cloudily into the oval mirror leaning cloudily toward her. They might fit the face of a big doll. It was near time for a break, so she went down to the front yard. "Daddy, whose are these?" He looked up long enough to see, then back at his paperback. "Mother's," he said. "She didn't use any like these." "My mother's." He turned a page. "Well, I never saw her wear them. Time you were old enough to notice, I guess she'd stopped reading." She spread the temples and set the glasses onto her face. The temples were tight, the nose piece rode high. She felt she had to squint her eyes to look through the round, half-dollar-sized lenses. Her father blurred in the watery field and seemed to have receded a pace or two. He looked up. She pursed her mouth. "You don't look the part." She took them off, folded them, and slipped them into the pocket of her smock. "I think I'll give them to Lisa for keepsake." "Sure." He turned another page. That night to Evan on the phone, she said, "I'm starting to feel like Goneril and Reagan rolled into one. I'm taking away his kingdom scrap by scrap." "Pretty melodramatic, Dot. You're just cleaning house. For his own good." "Thanks, buddy. Tell me something I didn't already tell me." "Be nice, or the kids and I'll cancel your homecoming party." "I'm serious. I'm asking myself, do I really need this? You know how it was after your mother died. You're saving trouble later on. Buying it now and not liking how it feels. You will later. We went over all this. It's your last good chance." Wednesday mid-morning, when she stood tiptoe to look out a basement window at the sale, she saw him ushering people around among the stuff on the lawn, inviting them to try the chairs, the daybed, cranking an egg beater, plugging the toaster into the extension cord to show it worked, tracing an explosion in the air with both hands to show it even still popped up. She didn't look out after that, and she saved her big find of the day, money, till supper. "What's this?" she asked him. "The first dollar you earned? And all these dimes?" She opened the cigar box and shook it. "That? I suppose it could be." He held it close to his nose, rotated it. "Sure didn't earn it in 1896. For my time. Keep it. Take it to a coin dealer, see if it's worth anything, do what you like. Give the dimes to your kids, put them in your car to feed parking meters." "Wait a minute," she said. "I'm starting to see something. You saved all this stuff, saved it and saved it till instead of being saved it might as well have been lost. Was lost." She took a breath. "It doesn't mean a thing to you." "Not now," he said. His hands rolled palm to back on the table, a shrug shrugging itself off. She saw, not now, that she was sorting it out, ripping her way through the thick nest he'd pulled around himself. It had had to be there, confused or forgotten didn't matter, just that it was there, everything or nearly everything that dropped into his life and rode with it, and now she was raking it away, and he was appallingly finding out he could live without it. No pleading or protests like Lear to his daughters, no reason, not the need. He'd gone beyond that. She swallowed hard. Just before sorting time that evening, she thought to ask him, "How much did you take in today?" He raised his eyebrows and smiled. She saw he had the cash box key on a thong around his neck. When she called Evan that night, she told him, "He's cooperating now. I don't think I'll call you again till Saturday, let you know if I really finished. You call me if there's anything in the store or at home I need to know about." "Sounds fine. You feeling all right?" "It hit me today. Mother must have put up with a lot of this, especially those last few years when she was so weak. Maybe all her life, at least as far as the attic and basement go. Don't get into that too far. How's it otherwise? You okay? He glad to have you there?" "You know I never could get close to him," she said. "But you could say we're getting along." "You might say that." Thursday's big find turned up in a box full mostly of old Reader's Digest condensed books. Several journals her mother had written, journals she hadn't known existed, for intervals in which she'd always supposed her mother kept none, including the year of her own birth. There was no time to read them home with her. And instead of taking them up and showing her father during a break, she saved them for supper. "Did you know about these, Daddy?" she asked, lifting the thin volumes from her lap and setting them in the middle of the table. He set his fork down, tines on his cubed steak, and dabbed his lips with his napkin. "Your mother's diaries, what my mother would have called her personal. I think I knew they were around. The red one I gave her for our 12th anniversary. Not what it should have been, papers some other year. Have you ever read them?" "Why, no, of course. They're hers, private." "When I was born is in here somewhere." She tapped with a chipped nail the cream-colored one. "Something anyone would want to know if her mother wrote about it." "It's yours." "I can't believe you. The woman you were married to for 46 years, and you don't even care about her journals." He was nodding his head. "Of course I do. I did save them. But it's none of my business. You keep them now. Read them. Do what you like. Start fires." Deserved or not, she'd pass that one off. Lisa would say, "You're totally weird. Don't you want to know?" "Aline told me everything I ever asked her, and a good deal I didn't. A lot I'm glad I've forgotten. I was there, you know, I was with her. What could those things tell me?" He cut a triangle of meat and lifted it to his mouth. She watched him chew deliberately, firmly, pause for a sip of water, while she dabbed at gravy with a shard of hard roll, stunned at how easily now he let himself be divested. Old coins and waste paper were one thing, but this, the nearest, she would have thought, the nearest thing, the last ragged scrap between his intractable heart and howling blankness. If she'd called Evan that night, she might have wept. As it was, she stayed awake long enough to hear not only the coughing and turning, but also two trips to the bathroom. 2 days each on attic and basement and 4 nights of sorting time got her through most of what had to be sorted to keep her discard, and Friday she got down to serious washing and scrubbing. By evening, she'd flat frazzled 3 old toothbrushes on groutings and the edges and inside corners of moldings and wainscoting. Not much was left on the lawn then either, and she dragged the hopeless lazy boy to the curb, filled it with unbought clothes, knickknacks, and kitchen stuff, and threw the center-worn area rug over the lot. There it was, one big grayish lump and a mound of bulging, black, gleaming bags. After supper, her father set the cash box on the table, took the key off his neck, opened the box, and turned it to face her. "Here," he said, "that's done with. Made $410, $225 for the big dining set alone. People really do this?" "Really do," she grinned at him. "Well, there you are. It's yours, your stuff, you earned it. Well, take your $60 change back anyway." "Deal." She took it, and they theatrically shook hands. At breakfast Saturday, beginning to wind down, she told him, "Finish up that omelet quick, we're going to a yard sale." "Huh? Thought we were sellers, not buyers. Throw her awayers, get ridders. You've been showing me all I don't need." "Well, there's one thing you do. A casket? I had a burial plan paid up for years. A desk? I can't imagine you've never had a desk. I've got a loan. Losing everything from paper clips to birth certificates. You're going to get a desk." "Tell me where, Miss Smartypants." "A place across town. There's an ad in this morning's paper that mentions a desk, which is why we're in a hurry to get there before somebody else takes it. Finish your eggs." He did, at his own pace, and they beat it across town and got there at the same time as a VW with a young couple, and she beelined for the desk, a small roll top made of dark wood, which he fingered, then tapped with his knuckle. He sniffed. "Cheap. Pine stained to look like mahogany. You wanted Spanish oak or curly maple? It's $20 and it will do the job." She tore another traveler's check out of the blue plastic wallet. "We'll take it," she told the woman sitting at the card table, and leaned to sign her name. That put her in the mood to browse and maybe buy some more stuff to send home, but there was still a day's cleaning to do, so they borrowed a screwdriver to detach the top from the bottom, slid the top into the back seat, and tied the bottom onto the roof of the car with twine, cushioned with a ratty blanket she'd left out for Goodwill and stopped to grab as she backed out of the driveway. She cleaned all the rest of Saturday, not even surprised to find her shoulders, arms, back, legs, and feet no longer ached, too tired to be very grateful for it. Before supper, she took her father on a tour of inspection, top to bottom. He stood in an empty basement room and called out, "Ha! Hello! Hear it ring?" he said to her. She'd heard. His voice clinked against the walls like a tenpenny nail. After he went to bed, she called Evan to say she'd finished and felt nearly finished off. And he said, "Great. Consummatum est." They had the welcome all set. Then she worked on the desk, cleaning and polishing it, setting it up in the foyer, organizing it for his use. Then she took the longest bath of the week, wondering if she'd fall asleep and drown in her reward. She didn't. She was so keyed up that night she couldn't sleep, her mind running over and over the empty house, going through and through it, as if bewildered in some huge hollow chamber inside her body. So she was still awake when the phone rang near 2 a.m. Her first thought was Evan calling back, some emergency at home. Then she bet it was a prank, and when she got to the phone in the hall on the third ring, she was right, heavy breathing. She growled furiously. The caller growled back, a rutting cat. "Oh, hang up and go to sleep," she said, and quacked the phone into its fork. "You or me?" She turned to see her father standing behind her, hands in the pockets of his dressing gown, sash neatly knotted. "I was coming. Why'd you hang up?" "Just a prank, Daddy. Some sex fiend huffing and puffing." "Ah, the big bad breath. The phantom vacuum. Calls a lot lately. Nothing to mind." "Well, why haven't you done something about it? Get unlisted. Have it traced. Blow a whistle." "Hell, you know what a runaround they give you if you want calls traced? This kind you got to promise to prosecute, get a court order. A fee for unlisted, and I couldn't stand the whistle myself. Let well enough alone. I wouldn't put up with it another day. Well, I think, what if it's just some harmless kid or some sick old person? Sick is right, and ruining your sleep. I don't sleep much anyway. Don't get many calls, you know. It's a diversion, a little more personal than late-night TV." "You don't mean that." "Yes, I do, I do. Last time I spoke right up. 'Hi, how are you, you son of a bitch?' And the guy or whatever just goes on breathing. So I say, 'Good to hear your wind. Good to know you're still alive. Keep sucking air.' Seemed to help. Hung up somewhere in there." He smiled mildly and she laughed from her toes up. "You're impossible," she said. Unpissable. Up early Sunday morning to be ready for the limousine to pick her up, she first served him crepes, then showed him how she'd organized the desk late last night while she'd supposed he was sleeping. "Now look," she said, "all your things, every envelope, rubber band, paperclip, pen, pencil, from all over the house." She pointed to pigeonholes, pulled drawers open. "It's all organized here. You won't have to look for it. You shouldn't lose it." He ran his fingertips across the writing surface she'd wiped with lemon oil the last thing before her bath. "And look here." She opened the center drawer and took out the two cigar boxes and set them on the desk and read the labels she'd written across the tops. "Bills to be paid, receipts to be filed." She looked at him. "Use them, okay?" He touched the corner of one with thumb and fingers. "Maybe you'd just best leave them here and not put them back in the drawer." He nodded. "I'm glad it's done," she told him. "I wondered if I could." "You did," he said. "You finished." She looked at him, the eyes that never wavered, red-lidded, the mouth set in its permanent slight down curve. She took in her hands the thin shoulders she hadn't touched since greeting him last Sunday evening, leaned and kissed his hard, smooth-shaven cheek. "I love you, Daddy. You needed this done. I needed to do it." "Good job, too," he said. His arms circled her in turn, and he held her a minute. The last good chance, she thought. Maybe the last time that ring of flesh and bone would close her. Turned and shut the small drawers in the top of the desk, shut the center drawer, then slid the roll top downward. It accelerated, fell of its own weight, and locked with a neat click. She leaned to peck his cheek again, then turned to peer through the side light. "I think it's here. I'm sorry I couldn't stay and go to church with you. This was the only flight that could get me back in time for the party." "Happy anniversary," he said. "About church, it doesn't matter. Maybe I'll just stay here." He swiveled slightly each way, indicating the clean, faintly echoing rooms. "I know that my Redeemer liveth," he said. Even then, turning, lifting her bags, stepping out the door, she suspected him of an elusive and complicated irony.